Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for Thursday, February 5th, 2009. I do want to let you know before we start that cell phones, BlackBerries, PDAs do interfere with the electronic recording equipment. So if you hear buzzing noises, please look down and turn off your electronic device. Thank you so much. We are going to take the two bills that are on the agenda today in the order that they are on the agenda, and I will start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 328, and I'm going to ask Lori, our committee administrator, to summarize the bill, please.
It's a brief summary, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 328 provides that a person engages in an unlawful practice under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act if the person uses unlawful collection practice in the person's business, vocation, or occupation.
Thank you so much. And here to testify is our Attorney General, John Kroger. And Keith Dabanovich, are you coming up with the Attorney General?
I am.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon. Chair Bonamici and members of the committee, thank you very much for having us today. And I'm ready whenever the chair is convenient.
Please go ahead. Thank you.
I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 328, which I consider a very important law enforcement measure. Right now in our state, debt collectors are required to comply with the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, which I believe is an uncontroversial law and a very good law. It was passed in the 1970s and provides a basic list of things debt collectors can do and not do in their business practices. I think that's a very good law. The problem is that it is broken all the time. At the Department of Justice, we've received thousands of complaints over the last few years of improper debt collection practices by debt collection companies. I think in this recession, that number is going to rise significantly. About 75% of those complaints, roughly, are from out-of-state companies, many of them very large national debt collection companies. About 25% of those complaints come from debt collector companies based in the state. There's a whole range of kinds of complaints that we get, and you're going to hear testimony from some victims today, as well as a summary of our complaints from Mr. Dabanovich. Many of them are that the debt collection company is calling repeatedly to collect a debt that has nothing to do with the person that they're going to call. We have lots of complaints of debt collection companies trying to collect debts that have already been paid. We have a very high number of cases involving abusive or threatening language. We've had threats over the phone. We've had complaints of use of racial epithets. We've had complaints about foul language on the phone. I think it's important to give the committee some sense of how pervasive this problem is. I think the complaints that we receive, even though they number in the thousands, are just the tip of the iceberg. Lots of people, perhaps some members of the committee themselves, have received these kind of calls. The number of people who actually pick up the phone and complain in writing or on the phone to the Department of Justice is, I think it's fair to say, a very small percentage of the people affected. Mr. Dabanovich is going to give you a summary of our complaints, what they look and feel like, but I'll give you just one example of how pervasive this problem is. So this is my private BlackBerry. I carry it around with me all the time, and I really don't give out the number to very many people. My family has it, and law enforcement officials in the state have it in case they need to get a hold of me after hours. This morning, I was sitting at my computer typing up my testimony to come to this hearing, and I received a call from a number I couldn't identify. Normally, what I do is simply hang up. I don't take the call. But I was typing up this testimony, and it occurred to me it might be interesting to take the call. So I took it, and it was a debt collection company. It was one that was based outside of our state. They were calling to collect a debt of $437, which they believe Louise owed them. I had no way of communicating to them that I wasn't Louise, except by using the buttons on my phone to tell them that I was Louise, so that I could actually get to a human being to talk with. So I pressed all the buttons. I spent some time on hold. I finally got a regular human on the phone. They explained to me that Louise owed a certain amount of money for an unpaid debt. I told them I wasn't Louise, and I wanted them to stop calling. And they said they'd do so, but and let me be clear, I don't think this company broke the law in this circumstance, though certainly this company has received a lot of complaints from Oregonians over the last few years. But the person said, you know, we have these phone numbers in our database, and often we have no idea who they really belong to. The fact, you could say it was a coincidence that I got one of these calls this morning about a debt I didn't know. I don't think it's a coincidence. I think this just happens to everyone so often now that it was bound to happen. So why do we have this problem of all these complaints here in Oregon? I think the answer is very simple. When most companies in our state and other lines of business break the law, the Oregon Department of Justice is able to respond with the Unfair Trade Practices Act, and we're able to take the appropriate enforcement action. If it's a first problem, a minor action, then we simply send a letter. That usually takes care of it. If it's a repeat offense, it's something more serious. A small fine might be in order. If it's a large company with a real track record of anti-consumer behavior that we think violates the law, then we might take legal action in the courts. Unfortunately, when debt collectors break the law, when they break the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, the Department of Justice is not allowed to do anything. Under Oregon law, we are not authorized to take legal action against people who break the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. What people can do as an individual plaintiff is to sue these companies. Now, the question would be, well, why isn't that a perfectly fine remedy? Why does the state have to get involved? The answer is very simple. If you've got a $300 dispute with a debt collection company, it's probably not going to be worth your while to spend $3,000 to hire an attorney to bring a claim to settle that $300 dispute. Most of the complaints we have about a relatively small amount of money, so that it wouldn't be economically efficient for people to bring those legal claims in court, even if they could afford a lawyer. And of course, a lot of the people who are caught in this circumstance can't afford to do so. Most states have some kind of mechanism in order to hold people accountable when they break the law. Unfortunately, we don't. Oregon is defenseless. I think the companies know about it, and I think they exploit it. They push the envelope. Sometimes they go past the envelope, and the result is frequent violations of our Debt Collection Practices Act. I don't think that is good for consumers. Even more important to me as Attorney General, I don't think it's good for the rule of law. I think it's a disaster for our state to have a law on the books that we simply don't enforce. So what is the solution? The proposal that we are bringing today before the committee, Senate Bill 328, that we support, is very simple. We don't want to change the Unfair Debt Collections Practices Act. We're not proposing that. We're simply asking that we be given the tools to enforce it. And that is what Senate Bill 328 would do. The bill provides that when debt collectors, whether they're located in the state or out of the state, violate the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, that is when they violate pre-existing law, and only then the state can take action under the Unfair Trade Practices Act. I think it's very important to note this does not change the legal burden that these companies face. They are already required to follow these laws. So we're not changing in any respect what they have to do to comply with the law. All we are doing is creating a mechanism by which the state can take the appropriate enforcement action, and we think that is an appropriate way to proceed. This will allow us to do two things that are very important. First, when we have companies that violate the law, we'll be able to hold them accountable. And second, we'll be able to join with other states in coordinated legal action against some of the very large companies that have a nationwide practice of violating the law. Right now, attorneys general around the country are engaged in two multi-state litigations against very large companies. There's a third that's being put together. There have been actions like this in the past. Oregon has never joined those multi-state actions. I can't join those multi-state actions now because we're not legally authorized to do so, because we're not allowed to take action to enforce the law. So we think this bill is important in part because it will give us the tools to participate with other attorneys general around the country to go after some of the major companies that are harming consumers. I want to say that I believe this approach is a reasonable approach to the problem. It's the more or less identical approach that's been taken in states like California and Washington. It is very moderate compared to the approach taken in some other states. In Texas, there are criminal violations of debt practices acts. We're not seeking anything like that today. These are purely civil remedies. I also want to point out that 99% of the businesses in the state are already subject to the Unfair Trade Practices Act. This is not in any way singling out debt collectors. It's simply closing a loophole that currently exempts them from the law that the overwhelming majority of businesses in our state already have to comply with. The Department of Justice has a very good track record of enforcing the Unfair Trade Practices Act. We do that professionally. We do that responsibly. We take into account the nature of the infraction. If it's an accident, it's a very different thing if a company accidentally or negligently violates the law as opposed to an intentional violation. When we consider what the appropriate legal action is, we consider the size of the company. We are not interested in putting companies out of business. We are not interested in having them have to lay off employees. We are interested simply in making sure that these companies comply with pre-existing law. And I will tell you, I take this power very seriously. If the legislature should decide that this is appropriate, I have offered to meet with Jim Markey on a weekly basis, if this law goes into effect, to go over the complaints that we've got and the proposed enforcement actions to make sure that we are proceeding in a way which is fair and responsible. There are some alternative actions that this committee could take. Let me say I've met with Mr. Markey, who represents debt collectors in the state, repeatedly to discuss various options. And if I could reach a compromise that I believe was in the public interest, I would do so. I would do so quickly. Unfortunately, I just don't think I can responsibly, given the alternatives that I've been presented and that I believe the committee has perhaps been presented. Some of the proposals, and if at a later time you'd like me to respond to specific ones, I'd be happy to do so. Some of the proposals, I believe, are unconstitutional. It's true that 75% of the complaints we get are from companies based out of the state, but it's simply not going to be constitutional under the U.S. Constitution to have a law which singles out those out-of-state companies and does not apply equally to the companies in the state. Similarly, some kind of licensing scheme which treats out-of-state companies differently from in-state companies, in my view, probably would not pass constitutional muster. It would wind up resulting in endless litigation over the constitutionality of the provision for the state. I also think it would send a very bad message to the business community. I think we are in a serious recession. I think it's important for the state to send a message to business that our regulatory system in the state will be even-handed and won't discriminate against out-of-state businesses on behalf of local businesses. Finally, I'd like to say that some of the proposals, I think, take us in the wrong direction. In the middle of a recession, I don't believe that we need to craft complicated new laws. I don't think we need to hire new employees. I don't think we need to create a new regulatory bureaucracy. I think what we should do as a state is something which is very simple but would help a lot of people, and that is simply enforce the law that is on the books. The last thing I would say, I'm new in this role as Attorney General, and I think some people might think, as a new Attorney General, I would show up and flood the legislature with proposed bills. I will simply tell you that this proposal is the only one that's floating around this legislature with my name on it. And that was done quite intentionally. I'm not interested in changing the law generally. I believe that is, of course, the responsibility of the legislature. My goal is simply to enforce in a professional and responsible manner the laws that we have on the books. And I believe this enforcement tool is necessary if we're going to achieve that. So I appreciate a chance to come and talk to you today and would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much, Attorney General Kroger. Committee members, is it all right if we hear from Mr. Dabanovich first and then ask questions? Is that all right?
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, my name is Keith Dabanovich, and I'm special counsel to the Attorney General. Since 2001, the number of complaints that we receive about debt collection agencies has repeatedly placed the industry in the Department of Justice's top 10 consumer complaint list. In 2008, we received 1,088 written consumer complaints about debt collection practices. We receive many, many additional calls that are not formal written complaints. So it clearly, at least in our experience, shows that there are a lot of consumer concerns about debt collection practices. Now, we know, as the Attorney General said, that there are a lot of people that never would pick up the phone to call the Department of Justice, nor would they ever think about filing a written complaint. And one of the reasons for that is they may not have any idea that the debt collection practice that was they were a victim of might violate Oregon law. So as a consequence, they would never think about filing a written complaint. Now, some of the inquiries we get are not actual complaints, and the data that I've provided you does not include the inquiries that just ask for information. We also recognize that sometimes complaints come in that are not about illegal conduct. Nonetheless, we believe that monitoring and tracking the complaints that we do receive is a good indication of what's going on in the industry. And that history shows that this is a problem and it's a repetitive problem. It's worth noting that the Federal Trade Commission receives more complaints about the debt collection industry than any other industry. And indeed, consumer complaints about debt collection practices rank number one among consumer complaints according to the National Association of Attorneys General. I'd like to give you some examples of complaints that we received in 2008. A mother wrote on behalf of her 27-year-old developmentally disabled son who still lived at home. They received threatening calls from a debt collection agency that was trying to collect a debt regarding a telephone call that was supposedly made in 1998. Now, the son didn't believe his parents when they told him that the debt collector couldn't throw the young man in jail. Now, the parents disputed the validity of the debt, and so the calls from the first collection agency stopped, but another collection company started calling them soon thereafter. We've received complaints of verbal abuse, threats of violence, and profanity. And we received a complaint from a consumer who received repeated calls to collect on a debt that he had already paid. Now, the consumer sent the debt collector a letter explaining and exhibiting the proof of payment, but the debt collector continued to call him, including calling him at work. Now, with a worsening economy, as the Attorney General has said, we expect a large increase in the number of people that fall behind on their bills. That's unfortunate, but it's going to happen. And likewise, we expect an increase in the number of complaints about debt collection practices. Now, we acknowledge that the Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act is only intended to prohibit unfair debt collection practices. It is not intended to allow people to avoid their debts. The concern that we have is that the law that was adopted by this Oregon legislature is simply not being enforced. And we believe that Senate Bill 328 will allow for enforcement of the law. I'd like to give you a little bit of history about the Debt Collection Practices Act and the Unlawful Trade Practices Act so that you'll understand how Senate Bill 328 would operate. In 1977, Oregon and the U.S. Congress adopted a Debt Collection Practices Act. And at that time, a congressional committee found, and I quote, debt collection abuse by third-party debt collectors is widespread and a serious national problem. Unfortunately, not much has changed, at least here in Oregon. It remains a problem. Well, what's illegal? Under our Debt Collection Practices Act, it is illegal for a debt collector to misrepresent the character, the amount, or the legal status of a debt. It's illegal for them to harass the debtor. It's illegal for them to threaten dire consequences, such as throwing somebody in jail, getting them fired, or seizing their property. It's illegal for them to call their place of employment if it interrupts the employment workplace. It's illegal for them to contact a neighbor and complain about the failure of someone to pay a debt. Those are things that this legislature decided in 1977 were illegal acts. Unfortunately, that statute has not been enforced since 1977. The legislature also has the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and that act is our primary consumer protection statute. It was adopted, obviously, to protect Oregonians from unfair business practices. That act sets out a laundry list of illegal conduct. For example, making a false or misleading representation of fact, like something is on sale when it's actually not on sale, or sponsoring a pyramid scheme, or selling counterfeit or knockoff goods. Our Unlawful Trade Practices Act also cross-references 42 other statutes and says that if you violate one of these other statutes, it is a per se violation of our Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Now, as I just described, the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act itemizes things that are illegal. And all we're trying to do is to identify those things as also being violations of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And what that does is it simply provides a tool to the Department of Justice to enforce the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. As the Federal Trade Commission said recently in its annual report to Congress, vigorous federal and state law enforcement in this area is essential to stop debt collectors who fail to follow the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Now, given the large number of complaints that we get, it's obvious that the present enforcement situation is not adequate. And you're probably asking yourself, why is that? Well, DCBS does not enforce the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. What they do is they register debt collectors, and what they do is, from time to time, cancel or refuse to renew a registration of a debt collector, and from time to time, they may impose some small fines. But the primary focus of DCBS is not on the relationship between the debt collector and the consumer. It's on the relationship between the debt collector and the business on whose behalf they're seeking to obtain money. So the typical complaint to DCBS is the debt collector collected the money but didn't give it to the company who is actually owed the debt. If the Department of Justice is given jurisdiction to enforce the debt collection statutes, what we would do is, obviously, as we do in any other consumer context, we would investigate the complaint and take enforcement action to the extent that is necessary. It's important to note that in this context, we do not represent the individual consumers. They still would have a private right of action or dispute with the debt collector. What we do as an enforcement body is we investigate, and our usual mechanism of resolving disputes is by a simple letter exchange with the company. We may do an investigation with a civil investigative demand, and most of those inquiries are resolved with assurances of voluntary compliance, not involving the court process whatsoever. It is in a very rare circumstance that the Department of Justice has to actually bring a court proceeding against a company for violating the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. As the Attorney General has indicated, a number of states already have the authority that we are seeking. For example, Washington, New York, Massachusetts, Texas, New Hampshire, Michigan, Florida, Montana, Maryland, Hawaii, Illinois, California, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina all grant the attorney generals in those states the ability to enforce their debt collection regulations. And as the attorney general said, Texas even criminalizes unlawful debt collection practices, punishable as a misdemeanor. Now, we are obviously not asking for permission to criminalize unlawful debt collection practices. But what we are seeking is to have the flexibility in enforcing the law so that if the conduct is pervasive and repetitive, that we can seek maximum penalties. If the violation is not significant, we intend to work with the collection agency to improve their compliance with the law. Our goal is simply to level the playing field. We believe that by enforcing the law against those that violate it, we are making it easier for those that are in compliance with the law to continue to do so and succeed in their business endeavors. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dabanovich. I'll start out with a question to the Attorney General. Attorney General, do you plan to, if this bill passes and you are given the authority, do you plan to enforce the law with your existing resources, or will you be needing new additional staff to do this work?
Chair Bonamici, that's a good question. We are planning to do it with the existing staff. We believe that we can do this in a cost-effective manner as part of our overall consumer protection strategy, and so we will not be asking for additional personnel, and I believe that we can do this without an additional fiscal impact to the state.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Dodd.
Oh, thank you, Chair. The question would be for the Attorney General, and that is basically the vast majority of the offenders, at least from the, I think from the testimony you gave, are from out of state. If the call is placed from a state that has lax laws concerning this area, are they in violation of Oregon law if the call is placed from a different state?
Chair Bonamici, Senator, that's a great question. Yes, if the call is a call into the state from out of state, and they engage in an activity which violates Oregon state law, yes, it would be a violation of our state law. And if we had the legal authority, we would go after them. I'll give you an example. If you had a big company in New York that, as part of their normal practice, was engaging in abusive or threatening calls to Oregonians, I would like to have the ability to take legal action against that company. One thing that you're going to see, I think, with increasing frequency in this area is collaboration between the different attorneys general around the country. And as I mentioned, there's a number of lawsuits currently underway where states have all combined their resources to go after a big company that's engaging in repeat illegal abuses. I would like to be able to participate in those suits.
Just a follow-up?
Sure. Yes, go ahead.
It just seems that if we're talking about individual states and how they handle this, that you made the comment that we need stronger laws federally and state. It just seems like this is one of those questions that would be better resolved at the federal level so we all play with the same playing field, because the problem that I have a little bit with your bill is that Oregon collection agencies, where you have direct jurisdiction, would come under probably under the thumb of the Attorney General, whereas in different states, it would be far harder to prosecute. So, which would drive the people out of the state of Oregon that are doing the jobs into the states where it is more legal. Just like most of the bogus complaints that we get on fraud come from, I think it's Nigeria, is it not? They run the scams where you want $1 million, but to collect your $1 million, it costs you $500. Please deposit the money, boom, boom, boom. And we can't prosecute those because they're on foreign soil. So could you just kind of go over that a little bit?
Yes, sir. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, I think that's a great question, Senator. First of all, this bill will restore us to a level playing field. Right now, we do not have a level playing field. The Debt Collections Practices Act is a matter of both federal law and state law in most states. Our state law essentially tracks that of the federal requirements. So this is is already a federal regulatory scheme. The standards by which companies have to apply all across the United States. What is uneven about our playing field now is that in most states, the ones that certainly that Mr. Dubanovich mentioned, they have mechanisms in those states for the state to enforce the law, to ensure that it's followed. And what's uneven about the playing field now is that Oregon is defenseless and that we don't do that. And so I think that's encouraged companies to engage in practices here that they would not be comfortable engaging in other states. I can simply tell you that if we had this authority, it would apply evenly to companies in the state and companies outside the state. I would focus our attention on the places where we get the majority of our complaints. You're absolutely correct. I'm in no way trying to impugn Oregon debt collectors as opposed to nationwide debt collectors. 75% of our complaints approximately come from companies that are based outside of the state. We would have a very even-handed approach to these companies, and I can assure you that we will go aggressively against companies wherever they're located who we think are repeatedly and intentionally violating this law.
Further questions of this panel? Senator Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So I don't know a lot about this area, but I am curious about a couple of things. One is, it seems like the scenarios, Keith, that you described and a number have been provided to us in writing, too, mostly consist of telephone conversations where there just are two people privy to the conversation. So how do you go about establishing what was said in a situation like that?
Senator Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum. The difficulty is, as you've identified, is that there are two parties to the conversation. And in general, our first inquiry is to the company and say, well, do you have a record of a conversation and what took place? And sometimes they record the telephone call, so there's a record. Sometimes they don't, but at least they keep an identification that a call was placed and who was on the call. And most of the time, on an individual basis, you're right. We can't identify who said what, so we're not in the business of trying to resolve that dispute. Our bigger concern is whether there's one company that has a track record of having engaged in that kind of practice. And the history of the Department of Justice is indeed to track whether there's a repetitive pattern of illegal conduct. While I may not be able to prove the existence or who said what to you on a telephone call, but if 25 other people were all called in a relatively short period of time by the same company and have the same response, it's a pretty good tip-off that that company's probably violating law in more than one case.
And just to follow up, Madam Chair, the scenario that the Attorney General described, the coincidental scenario of the call this morning, it does seem like those calls, they may be more annoying than they are life-threatening because you're not actually the debtor in that case. But does the approach that you propose here or the existing laws actually protect people from receiving harassing calls when they're not the intended recipient of the call?
Chair Bonamici, Senator, the call I received in no way, I think, violates the law. I mean, I think this was something that's happened very commonly, which is a database error identified me with a debt which I had no relation to. That isn't a violation of the debt collection laws. What would be is if the company repeatedly called my phone number and insisted that I was the person that I had to pay the debt, even though I bore no relation to it, had informed them that I bore no relationship to it, and had asked them to stop. And if you look at the pattern of complaints that we receive from Oregon consumers, that's one of the most frequent patterns that we have. If this company calls me back over the next couple of days, I will certainly let you know. That would be a violation of the law if they refuse to stop calling.
And Senator, we will be hearing some testimony about that issue on Senate Bill 386 later today.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, Vice Chair George.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Attorney General, for coming down and visiting with us. And I guess two questions for you. Number one, in the documents you've presented to us, I didn't see like a particular company that was sticking out. It seemed like a kind of a potpourri of several hundred companies that were engaged in it that got complaints. And I'm guessing that's just consumers who are aggravated that they got the call. Are you seeing players right now in the industry that you're specifically, if given the power, going to go after, or is it just preemptive power at this point? Because in this report, I didn't see anybody that was got more than just a few calls, probably proportionate to the number of calls they made. So are there bad players right now that you're just waiting to go after, or what's the situation?
Chair Bonamici, Senator, that's a great question. I will tell you that we have no particular companies in mind as I sit here today for enforcement action. I think the fundamental broader question is whether this legislature believes we ought to have this authority. If we did get the authority, I think we would begin in two ways. First, I think it's safe to say that those large national companies that have been identified by other states as repeat problem companies, we would look at those cases first, the ones that other attorneys general around the country have identified, to see whether we thought those cases had merit and whether we wished with this new authority to join those lawsuits. So we'd probably start there. Sometimes we agree with our fellow states. Sometimes we think that a large multi-state action is inappropriate, and so we would not join. So that's where we would start. And second, I think we would analyze the data that you've been given and try to identify whether there were any companies in or out of the state that we thought did have a particular pattern we were concerned with. I have to say, I think this would have great deterrent effect if the legislature took this step. I think our complaints would decrease because I think it is well known that there's no possibility of effective state legal action at this time. I think word would spread very quickly if the legislature took this step, and I think mere passage of the law would have a deterrent effect on behavior that's out there.
I'll offer quick. Yes, thank you. Thank you for that. I guess here's my view. When I look at a regulatory body like a DCBS that is working with these groups, and it appears that there's not any major bad players right now, but we don't want bad players to enter our market. It seems like to me that if you have a regulatory system that is doing a job that appears to be protecting consumers at some point, but we need some additional enforcement, especially as we're going into a recession, there can be more debt, that we would do that through the agency that has the licensing authority rather than the Attorney General's office, which is more of a litigation situation. So you do it through more of a regulatory process than a litigious process. And I guess I'd like to understand why we wouldn't first, if there doesn't seem to be a problem appearing right now that we'd go after immediately, why couldn't we work with the agency that seems to be regulating this on the licensing side rather than going directly to a litigation power?
Well, Chair Bonamici, Senator, I think I've perhaps with my response given you an improper impression of what we would do. I mean, I think these complaints are voluminous and serious, and we would take legal action. I mean, we have not begun to do the basic enforcement work of looking at these complaints and the numbers and deciding which companies we would need to sit down and talk with. But some of these complaints would make your hair stand on end. I mean, they really are cases, even some isolated ones, where I think it's very appropriate for the state to get involved. I think the question of what the right response is, whether you want a regulatory response by DCBS or a response through the Unfair Trade Practices Act by the Department of Justice, is a policy question that this committee will have to confront and make a decision on. I will tell you why I think the approach that we are supporting makes sense. First of all, though DCBS does licensing, they have no ongoing structure to deal with the consumer complaints in this area, to take appropriate administrative action against companies that are licensed. So we'd have to do some significant legislative work. You'd have to hire some new inspectors over at DCBS. You'd have to create a new bureaucratic structure in order to go through these complaints and decide what kind of regulatory action would be appropriate. We won't need to do any of that if we follow the approach of this bill. We are prepared. The instant that this becomes law should be to respond just like we do with all the other 99% of the companies in the state that fall under the UTPA. So I think it would be swifter and won't require the creation of any new bureaucratic structures. I guess the other thing I would say is that when people talk about DCBS, one of the things they say is, well, your real tool here is the licensing process. You can yank the licenses of these companies. The problem is that's like having capital punishment for speeding. You know, the truth is we don't want to terminate any businesses. I don't want to put any business out of work. I don't want to yank the licenses of any business. What we want to do is have what we have in every other circumstance except some very narrow ones like this, which is an enforcement tool that allows you to fit the legal response of the state to the severity of the violation. If all you have is the option of yanking someone's license, you're only going to act in the most extreme cases, and then when you do, you're going to terminate the company. And that's not the approach, you know, I think as a prosecutor, that's not the approach I would like to take. I think having a range of sanctions without creating a new bureaucratic structure is the appropriate thing to do.
Quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strange, I laugh because what you said is that I had I actually had to pay a bill twice one time. I paid the bill. A debt collector kept calling me. I just eventually paid the bill twice because I was having difficulty. So I'm sympathetic, I guess, with what you're saying. But I guess on the flip side is that give me a flow right now under current law how it's working. The calls come into your office and also DCBS. And, and when it's processed, this compiling of this information, is that given back to DCBS so they know who the bad players are when they're doing the license renewals? Are they communicating with them? Is there any kind of communication going on currently between the two offices that we could use the tools that we have in the toolbox now rather than creating a new litigation authority, I guess. Do you see? How are your offices communicating right now? And is that a process that we can enhance rather than granting a great deal more litigation power to your office?
Chair Bonamici, Senator, that's a great question. So here's what would happen now. If we get a serious volume of complaints about a company, we could contact DCBS. What they are set up to do is yank the licenses of companies that have complaints from the corporations or businesses who are attempting to collect the debt. So I'm not aware of any occurrence where they've taken away a license because of interaction between the debt collector and the consumer. I'm not sure whether there's any legal authority to do that. They might have some, but I think it would be highly controversial, and there'd be a real question as to what the appropriate standards were for taking someone's license away. I think the beauty of this is that there's no question about what the legal standards are. The legal standards for action are those that the Oregon legislature created in the 1970s under the Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act. So the legal standards for taking action are clear. I guess the other thing that, and this is very important to me, that some kind of regulatory process would not do is authorize the Oregon Department of Justice to participate with other states in these multi-state litigations against large corporations, debt collection corporations that are repeat bad actors nationwide. I would not have the authority to do that if this was simply a licensing matter over at DCBS. It's a tool that I would like to have. I think it's an appropriate tool for us to have. And there's not a regulatory process that would give me the power to do that. So, I mean, if we're I mean this quite sincerely. When you look at the volume of complaints, 75% of them are from companies outside the state. I think they're never going to respond unless we have the ability to take some legal action against them. And so that's why I think this authority would be important. I guess at the end of the day, I believe rather than creating more bureaucracy, I'd rather simply enforce the law that we have on the books now and do it like we do in all these cases, that's as professionally and responsibly as we can.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Burdick. Thank you. Can you, I mean, the advantage of the current system is, you know, it does go to court, which means there's two sides to every story. The debt collector is going to say, no, I didn't say that, and the consumer is going to say, yes, he did, and the court will sort all that out. What will be your process for getting to the facts and enforcing this law under your system, and how can you do this with existing resources?
Chair Bonamici, Senator, first of all, I think the reality is that currently these cases do not go to court. The vast majority of complaints we get, the person who's been harmed has no legal recourse. They are often people who cannot afford to hire an attorney, which would cost thousands of dollars. These complaints are often about relatively minor sums. You'd never get a lawyer to take them on a contingency fee because they're too small. If you speak to consumer protection lawyers who represent plaintiffs, they will tell you that there is simply no legal recourse because these things never get to court for those basic reasons of efficiency. I think that's why states like California, Washington have allowed the state to bring legal action on behalf of its citizens. The approach we would take is very similar to that we currently use under the Unfair Trade Practices Act, so that if we identified a company that was engaged in unfair practices, we would contact them, we would let them know that we've received a lot of complaints. We would, in some cases, request information. In some cases, we would simply sit down with the company, discuss what's happening, and try to reach a resolution. As Special Counsel Dubanovich stated, Senator, the overwhelming majority of these things never go to court. They're often resolved with a letter. We tell the company we've received some complaints about a certain type of practice. They write back to us saying, we'll fix the problem, we agree to fix the problem, and the matter is over. So I think it would be mistaken to think that this is going to be incredibly litigious. The other question you asked, how can we do it with current resources? You know, I think we are facing an enormous challenge as a state in terms of the budget. Obviously, this is no news to everyone on this committee who are responsible for trying to figure out how to fund all of our basic services. I believe profoundly that as we enter this recession, state government has to tighten its belt and learn how to do more with less. And when I look at this case flow, I do not believe it's going to be a crushing workload that would take a huge number of people. I think we can manage this workload with the consumer protection staff we have. And I'm confident that if we had that authority, we'd be able to do it.
Madam Chair, if I can just follow up, because I wanted to follow up on one of Senator George's questions, which is, what happens now? I mean, you send, when you get the complaints into your office, and of course you don't have jurisdiction, do you send them over to DCBS, and do they respond in any way? What happens now?
Senator, what we do now, I have to say I'm not happy with what we do now. What we do now is if we have a complaint, we try to assess whether we think there's any real merit to it. And in a lot of cases, for various reasons, we conclude that based on the allegations, we don't think the company has done anything wrong. And in that case, we don't take any action whatsoever. Currently, we send a letter to a company, and we tell them that we've received a complaint. It's possible that the complaint may violate the debt collection practices law. We also state that it could violate the Unfair Trade Practices Act. That is true only if the action were somehow unconscionable, which is such a vague standard. I'm not very comfortable trying to enforce it, quite frankly, when you're talking about an important industry like this. What I think we need is clear standards like we've got in the Debt Collection Act. We send a letter. We say we're not representing the plaintiff, but we've got this, and we'd like some feedback as to what the company proposes to do. Very often the company says, we'll fix the problem with this person. And, you know, when I first looked at this, I thought, well, then this looks like it's working. Someone complains, we fix the problem.
I guess the problem is I think these companies are quite happy to fix the individual problem about which they've received our letter. But they know that for every one of those actions where you've received the complaint and that we've responded, there are, you know, I think literally dozens of complaints that never come to the attention of the department. And we have no ability to really deter that ongoing action. They're not legally obligated to stop doing what they were doing. And so I don't think that's an effective response. It's it tends to resolve some issues for the particular consumer involved, but it doesn't do anything to police the ongoing violations of law in the marketplace. And you can see that by the steady increase in the complaints we've received.
Well, but to follow up, Madam Chair, if you do get a pattern of complaints, do you ever go to DCBS and suggest that a license be pulled or suggest that they do an investigation? I mean, you say that they deal mainly with relationships between collectors and their clients, but I don't see anything to prohibit them from expanding their review. And so how do you ever communicate with them since they do have this authority?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Burdick, there is a very good exchange of information between DCBS and the Department of Justice. What they do with the data once they get it, I can't answer. But as the Attorney General has already indicated, the DCBS does not have, at least to my knowledge, the authority to terminate a license based upon poor consumer connections or poor consumer relations. So that's an area where Senator George raised, geez, is this something that could be fixed over on the DCBS side? I presume it would require additional legislation, maybe additional regulations that would identify what the criteria are for the termination of a license if there was a poor consumer complaint. And that's not existent. And you know, I'm not sure DCBS is set up to be the adjudicator of a dispute between a collection agency and a consumer. And hence, that's why they haven't done that kind of license replication.
Senator, I want to explain it. At some point, we will be hearing from, we'll ask for input from DCBS, and I know Lou Savage is in the room. But what I would like to do now is to thank you for spending so much time, because I think you've thoroughly outlined the issues, and hear from some of the other people who are here today, and then we will follow up and get some input from DCBS as we move through the process. So thank you very much for your testimony. And I'm going to ask Janice Tui to come up with Julie Rutherford. Are you going to come with Janice Tui? Thank you so much. Welcome. Welcome, and please state your name for the record.
Oh, my name is Janice Tui.
Okay, you want to go ahead? Thank you.
Chair Bonamici and members of the committee, I am a citizen speaking on behalf of from my own experience. I am in support of legislation to enforce the abusive practices of third-party debt collectors under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. On September 23rd, I received a phone call on my work phone from a person identifying himself as Mike Block. He stated he was from a company called National Processing Division in California. He proceeded to ask me if I was Janice Schlegel, which was my former married name. I stated that actually I wasn't Janice Schlegel. He then asked if my Social Security number was and read a number that was only one digit off my actual number. He also asked if I lived in an address that I had lived at approximately 2 years prior. When I stated no to all three facts, he informed me that I was in fact lying. He stated that I was in serious trouble and would be arrested the following day at my place of employment for a debt that I owed that was going to court. When I asked the specifics about the debt and the court, he stated he could not give me that information and that I had better send money or I would be publicly arrested and that, quote, misery would fall upon me. I hung the phone up, and he immediately called back. He stated that he was absolutely serious, that I had committed a very serious crime, and that I needed to pay. He never actually stated an amount that needed to be paid or what the debt was, only that before he could give me the specifics on the court case, that I needed to send money. I told him that it was ridiculous, that I did not owe any money to anyone, I had not committed a crime, and I would not be paying any sum of money for information, and hung up. He proceeded to call me 9 times that day. The phone call started again the very next day at approximately 8 o'clock in the morning, and again he called 8 to 10 times. Each time he called, he was more and more irritated and insistent. I work in a building in which there are approximately 100 employees, and all of us sit in individual little pods that are side by side. It is very quiet in our building, as our job is to review medical records. Needless to say, the people directly around my pod could hear the daily harassing phone calls, which was extremely embarrassing. My coworkers began asking me who was calling, what did they want, and why they were calling me so often. If I hung up on him, he would proceed to immediately call me back. I repeatedly told him I did not owe any debt, I had not committed any crime. Each day he stated I would be arrested and publicly humiliated unless I took care of this matter immediately. After 3 days of this continuous harassment, I informed my manager of the situation. She informed our quality assurance and safety officer of what was going on. While he was in my cubicle talking to me about the situation, the man again called on my phone. The safety officer spoke to the man and informed him that this was in fact a state agency and that this was a scam, and he immediately needed to stop calling and harassing me. The man stated I had set this scenario up to get him to stop calling and proceeded to ignore our safety officer's request. At this point, the safety officer put in a request to have my work phone number changed to alleviate the constant calls and harassment. Needless to say, this caused not only an inconvenience and expense to my employer, it inconvenienced my claimants who were calling in to check on their claims. Since we could not state my new number on my previous phone line, the claimants instead received a message stating their number had been disconnected. This, of course, caused them great concern when they could no longer reach me, the analyst working on their claim. The situation not only made it more difficult for me to perform my job effectively, but also caused me great embarrassment and humiliation to the situation occurring in front of my coworkers and supervisors for a debt and a situation that in fact did not exist. I want to thank the committee for taking the time to listen to my testimony and encourage your support of the Senate bill and offer to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Tui, for coming and telling us your story. Are there any questions? Senator George.
Thank you. This was just a fraud that they were running? This wasn't a debt collector. This was a fraud situation?
They said they were collecting a debt, but he would never give me a specific amount, the name, no information. And when I asked, he said I needed to send money in order to get the information.
So I guess the question is that would this legislation help you? Because this has something to do with something different.
Well, my understanding is that it would fall under this act because he was harassing me for, in fact, a supposed debt.
Gotcha. Huh. Interesting. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Matt Wallace and Joanne Bowman, please. And then next I'm going to hear from, after this, I'm just going to let people know what's going on. After that will be Paul Cosgrove and Jim Marquis and Cindy, I can't read the last name, but does it make sense for you to come up with Paul and Jim? Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome back, Ms. Bowman. Please state your name. Did you flip a coin to see who's going first?
Not yet.
Okay. It's up to you.
I'll go first since you can say my name first. So for the record, my name is Matt Wallace. I'm the consumer advocate with Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. OSPIRG is a statewide citizens-based public interest advocacy organization. You'll have my written testimony in front of you. Substantively, I don't have too much I want to add in my my spoken comments that hasn't already been very well covered by Attorney General Kroger and Mr. Dabanovich. One thing I will stress, which I think it is important in the consideration of this very important bill. By the way, thank you, Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify before you today on this important issue. One thing I did want to stress is simply the timeliness of taking up this particular issue. We all know now that the economy is in a mess, and we also know that more and more people are starting to fall behind on all sorts of bills and all sorts of debts. In addition to the mortgage meltdown that I had the pleasure of testifying before this committee on a couple of weeks ago. Pleasure is the right word. We are also starting to see many other kinds of debt really become unmanageable for people all across the state. One key example is actually credit card debt, which by many accounts is expected to sort of be the next shoe to drop on the economy, unfortunately. In fact, the last couple of months, in December and January, we've actually seen record high credit card delinquencies all across the country. So we support absolutely Senate Bill 328 as a common sense solution to a problem that is very large now and that we expect to grow. I think the things that recommend Senate Bill 328 the most are its simplicity and its the swiftness that we can start to see, we believe, a real effect on illegal practices that already exist. Again, that bill would take a look at practices that are already, illegal under Oregon state law. But simply put, in practice and by statute, there's just no cop on the beat right now. Senate Bill 328 would put that cop on the beat, and we think that that's a win for and consumers. So I'll leave my spoken comments there and of course, answer any questions.
Thank you so much.
You
Ms. Bowman.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, I'm Joanne Bowman, and I am the Executive Director of Oregon Action. I won't read my testimony to you because you have it in writing, but I will say, as I was sitting here listening to the Attorney General speak, I realized that I was also a victim of unfair collection practices. And so when the Attorney General says most people don't know what the law is around what debt collectors can and cannot do, I have a perfect example to share with you. And so about a year ago, I moved, got a brand new phone number, did the, I won't say what company, but I did the triple package, got the phone, got the cable, got the et cetera. And so I got this great new phone number that nobody has. Well, every day I get home from work and there are like 12 messages on there from a bill collector for a person that's not me. And so my assumption was the last person that had that phone number clearly was the person they were looking for. So as a good community member, I called them up at the number that they left and said, I just got this number. It's not me. Please stop calling me. And what they told me was, we can't. Your number's in the computer. This is the number we're supposed to call, and we're going to keep calling you. And they called me all day, 7 days a week, nonstop. And to the point where I finally decided to tell that company to take that phone out of my house, because that was the only people that were calling me, and they were not calling me. They were calling the person that used to have that phone number. And so I was unaware that that was an unfair practice, and I would think that just telling them that the person they're looking for doesn't live there would be sufficient, but clearly that was not the case. And that actually went on for quite a period of time, until to the point where I just had them take the phone back. And so I will leave my public testimony at that. I appreciate the fact that the committee is considering Senate Bill 328, and I think it's a very important piece of legislation, because it is clear that the people that I know are people who are hardworking Oregonians who have lost their jobs and are responsible and want to pay their debts. And so when people get into a situation where they can't pay their debt, we should be trying to figure out how to work with people to help them, rather than the kind of harassing phone calls, intimidation tactics, and threats of jail and other activity that some debt collectors use in their goal of attempting to collect that money. So thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony.
You're very welcome.
Committee members, are there questions for this panel?
Thank you
again. Paul Cosgrove, Jim Markey, and Cindy, I'm sorry I can't read your last name.
Robert.
Welcome. Have you decided who's going first? Sounds like it's Mr. Markey.
Madam Chair, I believe I will. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Markey. I'm here today representing the Oregon Collectors Association, which is a trade and professional association of Oregon collection agencies that I've represented for a good many years. The Oregon Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act was passed by this body with the support of my organization, shortly after the after Congress enacted the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act in 1977. The Federal Act only applied to third-party debt collectors, not when it was originally introduced by Congressman Annunzio, but there were amendments along the way exempting everyone except third-party debt collectors. And so we supported this legislation in Oregon to create a similar act, an act that was actually modeled after the federal act, that would apply to everyone collecting a debt in Oregon, because we thought it was important to, for everybody to play by the same rules. The remedy under this act was a right of private action for by the aggrieved party for $200 or actual damages, together with punitives and attorney fees. That, I believe, I think that coupled with some regulatory measures that we had under DCBS really served us well for a number of years. We had in place under the Licensing Act at Department of Consumer Business Services provisions that required collection agencies doing business in Oregon to have an office here, to maintain their records here, bank accounts, trust accounts, etc. Along the way, the legislature allowed passed legislation that allowed DCBS to waive those requirements for out-of-state collection agencies, and I would not in any way fault DCBS for waiving the in-state offices requirements or the record requirements for out-of-state collection agencies, because I think they were looking at it as not interfering too much with interstate commerce. But the fact of the matter is that once we began that process, we went from about 200 collection agencies in Oregon to I think today 760 collection agencies, and most of those new ones are from out of state. They don't have offices here, they don't have presence here, they make calls from Texas or Chicago or wherever, and there's not a lot of regulation by or any regulation by any agency, state agency, in terms of that debt collection activity. The DCBS doesn't have direct authority to enforce violations of the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, nor does the Attorney General. The remedy, again, is a right of private action. There are private actions brought, and there are lots of consumer lawyers who bring them. But the policy question becomes, in light of the fact that we have about, according to the Attorney General now, 1,000 complaints a year, 800 and some last year, I believe, on collection agencies. Should a state agency be involved in a regulatory scheme in addition to the right of private action? And our association has come to the place where we believe consumers should have a place to go. And the difference that I have with Attorney General Kroger and had with his predecessor is that I believe it should be under the Licensing Act, and that that's where it belongs. We think that DCBS can do an adequate job if we give them the resources to do it, and they have a lot of experience in regulating collection agencies in other areas, but have not had the specific authority to regulate them in this area. We're currently in the process of drafting amendments to House Bill 2300, which resides in Representative Hovey's committee. And I've been in discussions with DCBS for some time about this, to actually increase our licensing fees substantially, almost, I think, about double, and have three people hired at DCBS to do nothing but to enforce these actions. We think that is the proper venue for this. We think that they will do a better job, and they have one thing that the Department of Justice will never have. They have the right to take somebody's license, the death penalty, if you will. And frankly, if some of these companies are doing some of the things that Mr. Kroger and his comrades believe they are, and I have no reason to doubt that, then maybe they shouldn't be doing business in Oregon. And I think so I don't think there's anything wrong with taking somebody's license if they're violating this law. And I would just say, in response to Mr. Kroger's comments that DCBS doesn't do much. In the year before last, they levied a $40,000 civil penalty against a collection agency that had been doing business here without a license. Last year, another agency, $29,400 civil penalty against unlicensed agencies. So, that's an area they have power to enforce, and they do enforce in those areas where they have enforcement power. So I wanted to say, first and foremost, that we are moving towards some kind of regulation of this activity, and we think it's important that we do so. I've had kind of an ongoing debate with the Department of Justice for a number of years about when is a complaint a complaint. And we can say we have 850 complaints. Are they valid complaints? What are they exactly? Well, they're really contacts. And what we've been trying to do is to establish what really is the extent of this problem. And I was hoping we had talked with, actually with Better Business Bureau, we were going to review 1 year's worth of complaints, but because the Department of Justice felt they had to redact certain information from files before they gave them to us and a lot of other procedures, they wanted about $6,500 up front to give us 1 year worth of complaints, and our little association really didn't have the wherewithal to proceed with that. But just as an example, I would say, since the Department of Justice gave you an example of what they would consider an egregious complaint, I'll read you one. This says, I received a call from this agency this afternoon at my place of employment. This is a collection agency, and I was threatened with a lawsuit. I have since set up a payment arrangement with the agency, but would like to know if there's anything that I can do because I was called at work and could have potentially hurt my employment. She indicated on her form that she mailed to the Department of Justice no action was requested, and calling at the place of employment is clearly not a violation unless you've been told not to do so. That agency then receives a letter from the Department of Justice. Department's Financial Fraud Section has received a complaint alleging that your business may have violated the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. In addition, you may be in violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act if, in the course of your business, you employ unconscionable tactics in connection with the collection or enforcement of an obligation. Copy of that complaint is enclosed. This office enforces the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. We do not represent the complainant, but we review all complaints to determine whether action is warranted, et cetera, et cetera. We would appreciate receiving a response within 15 days. And the collection agency writes back and says, so our office called her at the place of employment and discussed her debt with her. After the conversation was over, the collector was told not to call her at her place of employment, and our records were updated accordingly. It is not our company's intention to disturb someone at their place of employment if we know it would become burdensome. End of. So many times these, I had complaints in my office, redacted complaints, simply we're complaining because somebody sent a validation notice, which is required by federal law. So we don't know how many of these are really valid complaints. I do think that there are plenty of valid complaints and that we ought to be overseeing them. I just think that putting this under the Unfair Trade Practices Act as an automatic violation of unfair trade is an overreach. And I think it better belongs under the licensing agency. Now, the reason I say that is the Unfair Trade Practices Act has been set up to regulate fraudulent and deceptive trade practices. That's what if you read the act, that's what it's about. I mean, on and on about fraudulent this, deceptive that, tell them one thing, mean something else, bait and switch, all of those kind of things. Under the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, there are lots of do's and don'ts, and you cannot willfully violate any of these do's and don'ts. But in a court case, and you'll hear probably from your consumer lawyers and others when you hear the other bill, the courts have actually held that acting negligently is willful. And so if you make a mistake under the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, and not meaning to. You well could have violated the Act, and therefore then you would have violated the Unlawful Trade Practices Act and subjected yourself to $25,000 civil penalties and all the other things that go with that. And if I could, I'd just read a short paragraph from the Unlawful Trade Practice, Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act to give you kind of a flavor. These are under prohibited acts. It is prohibited to do this, that, and the other thing, and to telephone a debtor's place of employment without informing any other person of the nature of the call or identifying the caller as a debt collector, but only if the debt collector, in good faith, has made an unsuccessful attempt to telephone the debtor at the debtor's residence during the day or during the evening between the hours of 6 p.m. and 9 p.m. The debt collector may not contact the debtor at the debtor's place of employment more frequently than once each business week and may not telephone the debtor at the debtor's place of employment if the debtor notifies the debt collector not to telephone at the debtor's place of employment or if the debt collector knows or has reason to know that the debtor's employer prohibits the debtor from receiving such communication, etc., etc. So there are about 10 little technical things you could violate there, not meaning to, and I just think subjecting people to the penalties that are available to the Attorney General under unfair trade may not be appropriate in those cases. Another concern that I have had as I look at this policy. In our regulatory schemes in Oregon, whereby we regulate all kinds of professions and businesses, fines and forfeitures, fines and penalties accrue to the general fund. And there's a reason for that. We don't want regulatory agencies driven by budget considerations. One of the rare exceptions to that rule is the Unfair Trade Practices Act. Fines accrue to the program. And I think that's a dangerous concept. So, for those reasons, we think that another regulatory scheme would be better. And I do want to say that I think Attorney General Kroger has good intentions. I think that his communication with DCBS will be better than his predecessors, and his predecessor was a friend of mine, but we argued about this all the time. When the staff from Department of Justice says that they are in regular contact with DCBS on these complaints, I would just tell you that regular contact is a quarterly report, Not four times a month, four times a year. They get the DCBS gets a list of the complaints that were filed for the previous quarter. And that's only been going on for about 2 years. And prior to that, there was no contact that I know of. So I just think we could do a lot better job in coordinating these efforts. And I agreed with what Senator George pointed out about using the regulatory agencies that are there under the Licensing Act.
Thank you, Mr. Markey. Mr. Roberts is going next. Thank you. And I'm going to ask if you could, both committee members and people testifying, I'd like to at least get to the other bill. I know we have people here from out of town, so if we could keep comments short and questions to those that are essential, I would appreciate it, and I'm sure others would too. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm proud to represent NACM Oregon, which is an affiliate of the National Association of Credit Management. We serve clients in Southwest Washington, Southwest Idaho, and all of Oregon. Our work includes credit reports, educational courses, account management, and collection services for 970 corporations in Oregon, all the way from your smallest businesses to the high-tech giants, from Boyd's to Bonneville Power Administration. We have quite a few clients in Oregon who are interested in this issue. In 2008, for those clients, we received almost 5,000 collection claim cases that we had to go forward with, and the total of those collections was over $12 million. In the last 10 years, we have had no complaints lodged against our company or any of its employees. So that may make you wonder, well, then why do you care? What do you care if the AG can prosecute when you're not doing anything wrong? And I'll tell you why. It's because the Unfair Trade Practices Act faults things as simple as human error. Those can be prosecuted and fined. Human error. Let me give you an example. About 10 years ago, our company sent out a letter, and within the letter it referred to interest being owed, and it should have said late fee, and someone wrote interest. And as soon as it was brought to our attention, we claimed it, we settled on it, and we kept it out of court. Under unfair trade practices, it would be something that we could be prosecuted for. Human error. Now, the Attorney General says that he does not, in fact, want more cases to go to court, and he wants to settle them before they get that far. But I can't help but wonder how that is different than what we have now. He himself said that usually a letter from his office simply telling someone that they may, in fact, be violating the Unfair Trade Practices Act is all that it takes for them to stop. So I'm not sure why we need to add a third layer of regulation to legitimate in-state Oregon businesses. We would argue that most of the businesses that have caused the problem are out of state, that they do not fall under DCBS regulation, but this prosecution is not needed and has already been shown to simply work for Oregon companies. It's the out-of-state ones that it's not working for. So we ask you to look at different ways to solve the problem. One is Mr. Marquis' bill, House Bill 2300. In Idaho, in order to give more teeth to prosecution, they tried something different. They required all of the businesses to have a large trust account and to have a resident business in the state. Those two ways, we think, would solve the problem better than Senate Bill 328. Well,
thank you so much. Mr. Cosgrove.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove appearing on behalf of the Oregon Financial Services Association. And I'm going to talk just about a different impact of the bill. You've heard a lot about third-party debt collection, people who are taking debts that were originally owed to some person and are now assigned to them and are doing the collection activity. My members are, in fact, lenders. And along with other state-licensed lenders, credit unions, banks, and others, we have, as the United Financial Lobby, opposed this bill in its prior iterations, in prior legislatures, and do so here as well because it affects us as well as it does third-party debt collectors. In contrast to some of the things you've heard about what DCBS does with respect to debt collection, which Mr. Marquis has talked about, modifications to strengthen that process, we are in fact fully regulated by DCBS. Lenders, the lending process is from making the loan to collecting the loan, and we have auditors in our offices looking at that process and whether we're complying with a whole variety of state and federal laws in that process, including debt collection practices. So for us, the enactment of this bill would not meet one of Attorney General Croner's stated objectives, which is to avoid a new regulatory bureaucracy. For us, it would add a new regulatory bureaucracy to the one we already have, one that functions well, one that audits us closely and continuously. So for that reason, we would oppose Senate Bill 328. I point out that in contrast to what is described as the current, maybe soon to be changed, but the current regulatory authority of DCBS with respect to collection agencies, DCBS's primary goal with respect to lenders is first our relationship with our borrowers and whether that's in accordance with law. And for those of us who are depository institutions, that not being my members, but certainly other members of state regulated financial institutions, our relationship with our depositors. But those consumer relationships, either with borrowers or depositors, are DCBS's primary emphasis. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer
questions.
Thank
you so much. Does anybody have any pressing questions?
Real quick one.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought the Attorney General made a very good point that taking away somebody's license is death knell. So if additional power was handed over to DCBS, would the industry be open to the concept of allowing DCBS to maybe rather than just revoke a license, subject a firm to a fine? Violation.
Madam Chair, Senator George, I apologize. I didn't make myself clear.
Department of Consumer Business Services, under the regulatory scheme that's already in place, has cease and desist. They have civil penalties available to them, and they have suspension and revocation of license. And we would make that available to them in enforcing unlawful debt collection practices as well. And in addition, we would ask that there be more coordination, not less, between them and the Attorney General, and that where they had cases that were truly egregious and rose to the level of unconscionable tactics, for instance, that they be forwarded to the Attorney General for prosecution.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just one quick question, Madam Chair. I have a lot of questions, but we obviously don't have time for them. So just this one. We heard testimony earlier that we need to change the law to allow the state to participate in multi-state actions, which would go after exactly the companies that you all seem to be acknowledging are not the ones that you represent, but companies from out of state that have patterns and practices of bad behavior. So why would you be opposed to giving tools to our State Department of Justice that we don't have now to go after companies that I would think are making the entire industry look bad?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, I'm saying I am willing to give additional tools to the state of Oregon to go after bad actors. We just think it's more appropriate to do it under the Licensing Act than through the Attorney General's office. And I'm not, Mr. Kroger made reference to this need in a change in the law, but I'm not familiar with what he is referring to, so I guess I'd need to get that information from him before I could comment on the exact nature of what he's talking about. Because I do think he has authority to join with other states now, certainly on many matters. I don't know how he is prohibited in this instance.
Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum, for holding the rest of your questions. I'm sure we'll have more opportunities to ask them. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Angela Martin and Sybil Hebb. And Angela and Sybil, I'm sorry to do this, but if you could keep it short, I'd like to get at least some time for the other bill. Thank you. Welcome.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, thank you very much. Angela Martin with Our Oregon. I will keep my comments very short as you have them written in front of you. I want to add to the record our support for Senate Bill 328 and looking forward our support for Senate Bill 386. As we've heard many folks explain, there is a clear gap in the law where enforcement of consumer protections falls solely to the consumer to enforce themselves. We see this as an inadequate tool for the large number of small infractions that point to a systemic problem in this system. We believe that the Unlawful Trade Practices Act and the Attorney General's Office is an appropriate place to place this enforcement tool, and I would echo what we've also heard, that it would not set up a regulatory scheme that's much different than one that we currently see for enforcement of many of Oregon's fine consumer protection laws. We do turn to the Attorney General's office for that type of enforcement. There's no reason that this industry should be exempt from that level of protection. I'll quickly add that I, too, have my own personal experience with this and was threatened with having my driver's license totally suspended. And when I asked for proof of the debt and questioned their authority to suspend my driver's license, the debt collector ceased calling me. These are common problems, and we need an effective tool to enforce the laws on the books. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sybil.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center in support of Senate Bill 328. I echo the comments of many before me. I think that we can all agree we don't want consumers in a position of having to return their home phones or defend themselves over the phone against these rogue practices. practitioners, I do agree and acknowledge that there is an appropriate and valuable role for debt collection companies in Oregon, and don't mean to suggest anything otherwise, but by the same token, it's appropriate for the state to play a role in effectively enforcing our standards and practices that are codes that we have adopted for good public policy reasons. I frankly think that the idea of providing the Attorney General with the authority to file lawsuits is the only effective way to really appropriately address the injuries that some consumers suffer in egregious cases. Administrative action can be quite a good tool in many less severe cases, and I'm frankly supportive of that mode of regulation as well, and some linking between the two. But I think without the ability of a state agency to file independent actions to take care of the most egregious practices, we don't have an effective and full system. So I appreciate your time and attention.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Any questions? All right, that's all we had on Senate Bill 328, and I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 328, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 386, and I'm going to pass the gavel to my vice chair, and I'm going to introduce the bill.
We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 386, and welcome the chair. And
thank you very much, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. I am Suzanne Bonamici, State Senator for Senate District 17, and I'm here to introduce Senate Bill 386 and to express my support. There's no escaping the fact that we're in difficult economic times. You know, we talk about it every day here in the Capitol. We talk about it in our homes and in our communities. And this is a time when we probably all know someone who's having some sort of trouble paying his or her bills. And as we heard from the good vice chair today, sometimes people simply end up paying because they don't want to take any more phone calls from debt collectors, even if they may dispute the debt. The Debt Collection Practices Act isn't about restricting the legal and ethical collection of debts, but what this bill does is to make clear what debt collectors can and can't do and to give consumers more effective remedies. And I really see this bill as leveling the playing field and giving consumers the enforcement tools they need. And Senate Bill 386 does this in several ways. First, it adds the very common sense provision that prohibits debt collectors from making false or misleading statements, which is not in the current law. It also deals with a problem that's being faced by a large and growing number of consumers, and that's the attempt to collect a debt that doesn't exist. Of course, anyone can make a mistake, but if the debt collector is told that the debt has been discharged, for example, in bankruptcy, it should be the responsibility of the collection agency to stop collecting that debt, and this bill clarifies that. Now, we heard some talk about how difficult it is for consumers to bring a case against a collection agency. Currently, there is a risk that the consumer will have to pay attorney's fees both for himself or herself and for the other side, the debt collector. That's unusual in consumer protection laws. In fact, just today, the National Consumer Law Center issued a report about consumer protection statutes nationwide, and Oregon is one of the three states joining, I believe it's Alaska and maybe Florida, that actually allow a provision for the consumer to have to pay attorney's fees, even if that consumer brings the case in good faith. So Senate Bill 386 corrects that and says that in the suit alleging an unlawful collection practice, the consumer will have to pay the debt collector's attorney's fees only if the suit is shown to have been brought in bad faith. Also, the current law has a one-year statute of limitations. This bill says that the statute of limitations begins to run at the date of the injury or the date that the unlawful practice is discovered, giving more time for consumers to assert his or her rights. And finally, some collection agencies will attempt to just run out the clock with the one-year statute of limitations, they can wait until day 366 and sue, and then the consumer cannot assert a violation of the law as a counterclaim in defense. This corrects that and makes it the same as the Unlawful Trade Practices Act by allowing the consumer to assert a violation of the act as a counterclaim. This bill, Senate Bill 386, addresses the lopsided nature of current debt collection law, leveling the playing field and creating access to justice for consumers. It will not harm and should not harm the majority of collection agencies who do their business ethically and legally. It will, however, substantially impede the minority of the businesses who prey on Oregon consumers through the use of unlawful practices. It is not inconsistent with Senate Bill 328. I think they're good companion bills, and I support them both. And Mr. Vice Chair and members of the committee, I urge your support for Senate Bill 386. Thank you very much. Do you have any questions?
Thank you, Senator. I got the gavel over here, and all of a sudden didn't ask Lori. Lori, is there anything you need to add and explain it? Although the good senator has done a great job summarizing the bill. So.
I think she's done just fine. I defer.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you for your indulgence. I'd like to call Justin Baxter, please. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. My name is Justin Baxter. I'm a consumer lawyer in private practice. I represent identity theft victims and other consumers in credit reporting and unlawful debt collection cases. And I appear today as a citizen in support of Senate Bill 386. I want to begin by saying I appreciate the testimony of the Attorney General and the witnesses. I think it underscores the prevalence of these problems and the urgency of these issues. This particular legislation will cure a number of defects with the Oregon UDCPA, the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. Today, given our short time, I'd like to focus on two of those defects that are most urgent. The first is a change that will protect consumers from lawsuits and threats of lawsuits over invalid debts, non-existent debts. The second is to remove the threat to consumers from paying the attorney's fees of collectors when they bring good faith claims but ultimately do not prevail in court. The first issue, the first change is an amendment to subsection K of the UDCPA, and it is intended to fix a line of appellate court cases that began with the Supreme Court case Porter versus Hill, the Oregon Supreme Court case Porter versus Hill. Porter held that filing a lawsuit over an invalid debt did not violate the UDCPA. That decision has been extended over the years to the point now that courts have held that demanding payment of an invalid debt does not violate the statute. And as we've heard today from a number of witnesses, this is an increasing problem in Oregon. The reason that this has come to a head is I think the convergence of two recent trends in debt collection. One is clearly identity theft. We know from the FBI that this is still the fastest growing crime in this country, and Oregonians have been hard hit by ID theft for certain. The other trend in collections is the rise of these third-party debt buyers that essentially buy large amounts of account numbers, balances, and account information essentially on a spreadsheet, and then go out and demand payment and ultimately bring lawsuits against consumers. In many, many cases, as we've heard, these are consumers that don't actually owe debts. And I do want to point out, I've attached some documents to our written testimony, and I'll pass on Exhibit A, except to just say that this is the in-court statement of one such collection attorney who affirms the fact that thousands of lawsuits are filed for his law firm. It's in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, but the vast majority of the cases, in his words, go to default judgment, and he indicates there's expense to the plaintiff in purchasing the supporting documentation. In other words, lawsuits are being filed on cases for which there is no underlying proof. These are breach of contract claims that are filed without a contract. Moving past Exhibit A, I want to show the members of the committee what's more troubling, that these cases are being brought in bad faith, and it is a fraud upon the courts. It is an abuse of Oregon consumers, and I'll direct the members of the committee to Exhibit B. This is a series of affidavits that are typically filed in collection lawsuits, and they purport to support the collector creditor's claims. What's troubling about Exhibit B is the person who signed the affidavit. You can see towards the bottom of the page, this affidavit is signed by somebody purportedly Martha Kunkel, the designated agent. That's page 1 of 11. Curiously, if you look at page 2 of 11, this is another document signed by Ms. Kunkel, but it's a different signature. And if you look at the next pages, the members of the committee may note that there are at least three different signatures for Ms. Kunkel. And again, it just underscores our concern that these cases are being brought in bad faith without the underlying documentation or proof. A series of affidavits are listed as Exhibit B. I'll show you also briefly Exhibit C is another series of affidavits, again, filed in collection actions by creditors and collectors. And these are a series of affidavits filed by an individual identified as Sarah Rubin. What's troubling about Ms. Rubin's affidavits is that she seems to be filing affidavits as the custodian of records and the bookkeeper, the record keeper for a number of different businesses. The first affidavit is for Capital One Bank. Page two is also Capital One Bank. Page three is an affidavit for North Star Capital. Page four is an affidavit identifying her as the bookkeeper for Commonwealth Financial Systems. Page six, again, we're back to Capital One Bank. Page 8, another Capital One Bank. Page 9, another North Star. And the reason I show this series of affidavits to the committee is to show that there is an imbalance between the information that the consumers have, that the debtors have to protect themselves, and what is being brought in court to substantiate these claims, largely without justification or underlying documentation. But more importantly, going back to the testimony that we've heard today from so many witnesses, there is a serious threat of consumers being dunned or having payment demanded from them or having lawsuits filed against them over debts that they don't owe. And the concern that we have and the problem that has that is clear is that under the Porter line of cases, those demands for payment, even on an invalid debt, ostensibly do not violate the UDCPA. That's a significant gap in the protection of the statute, and as we've heard, it's one of the most prevalent problems for consumers. So we we truly need a fix to that that case law. The second matter that I'd like to address is that of the so-called loser pays attorney's fees. This is a separate section of the statute, or ORS 646-641. And let me say at the outset, we're not suggesting that we take away the loser pays scheme entirely. But rather, the statute is going to be modified to say if the court finds that a case is brought in bad faith or a frivolous UDCPA lawsuit, then the court has the ability to impose attorney's fees. But at the outset, a consumer that brings a good faith claim under the UDCPA should not have held over the head the sword of Damocles of paying a debt collector's large attorney's fees solely because they don't prevail at the very end of their case. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions either now or later.
Thank you so much, Mr. Baxter. Any questions? Well, thank you so much for your testimony. I'm going to have Jeff Hassan and Jim Marquis, and then following that, I'll have Matt Wallace, Sybil Hebb, and Keith together. And I plan to go a bit over. I hope the committee members can stay for just a bit so we can get this testimony. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim Marquis again on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association here to oppose Senate Bill 386. With all due respect, Madam Chair, I realize it's your bill. We think it's a little overreaching. We think it tips the scales too far in a direction that it shouldn't tip to. I have with me today Mr. Jeff Hassan, who is the attorney for the Oregon Collectors Association, and I'm going to turn it over to him and let him go through some of the issues that we have concerns with in the bill.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeffrey Hassan. I'm an attorney for the Oregon Collectors Association. I represent a number of collection agencies and creditors in matters and do defense work on cases that are filed on the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act in Oregon, Unlawful Debt Collection Act. Excuse me. And as we know, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act was set up for a specific purpose, and that was to, the purpose is to eliminate abusive debt collection practices by debt collectors, to ensure that those debt collectors who refrain from using abusive debt collection practices are not competitively disadvantaged, and to promote consistent state action to protect consumers against debt collection abuses. The problem that we have with this bill is that it goes a little bit too far as it doesn't necessarily protect abuses. What it does is it adds a violation for mistakes. And with regards to the standard in there, a negligent violation of the act. For example, if you sue on a debt and there's a dispute on the debt and you lose, under this act, I believe that there would be a violation of the Debt Collection Practices Act, assuming it's a consumer debt, because it would be a negligent violation. You'd lose the lawsuit, and that would make it a false representation as to the debt. And so, because it's a strict liability statute, you may have potential liability of the $200 or actual damages plus attorney fees from the other side. If you have a disputed debt, you should have the ability to litigate that debt and have some fact finder decide who's right and who's wrong on the disputed debt. And so that's, on a false statement, that's not consumer protection, it's negligence, and it's not something that would be that should be subject to a state statute. The other issue with regards to it is the attorney fee provision. With regards to the attorney fee provision, a loser pay, the creditor and the debtor both may have representation. And what's happening in this particular statute is the creditor is going to pay all the attorney fees, and so therefore it becomes an attorney fee driven claim over a $200 amount. And the problem is that the creditor's in an economic position that's unlike the consumer's position as far as resolving the case. With loser pays, at least there is an equal position, more equal position that the parties can decide as to resolution, whether or not the attorney fee should be paid by the creditor in defending the case or not, and with the also added issue that the other side would have that problem if they went forward on a case that was nothing more than a negligent violation. With regards to the other issue is the date of discovery. Right now that changes the act that as to where we are right now. Instead of having the date of the violation, which is consistent with the federal act, being from the date of the violation or injury, which is 1 year. Now we've changed it, and we have date of discovery, which could open up date of injury or practice on, a negligent violation that's totally inconsistent with the federal act on a strict liability case. And finally, with regards to the statute of limitation on counterclaims, in my view that if this particular provision, if you have a consumer debt and you don't put a Debt Collection Act counterclaim in there, which would give you the right to attorney fees for winning, that it would be, in my view, malpractice, because on a consumer claim, if you win, you're going to have a false representation to which the consumer would be entitled to attorney fees, whether or not there's a separate attorney fee right there or not. So with all these issues involved in this particular case, I think it goes a little bit far afield as to getting the people that are actually abusing consumers versus those that are making mistakes.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, Senator Dredd?
Thank you, Chair. The question I would have would be, if you were an attorney and you were summoned before your agency for not paying debt, it would seem to me that he could then run up as much legal fees as he wanted because he would not be liable for the debt under this bill. So it would be attorneys not to pay their bills. I mean, it sounds like it could go to that extreme. Is that do you kind of read it that way?
Madam Chair, Senator Girard, I couldn't have put it better. So it's really one of those issues, and I've seen those cases come up, and matter of fact, have one in my office right at this point. I have a case where and I've had these in the past, where there was a person that actually have a letter acknowledging that they owe the debt, and because of the challenge based on the Debt Collection Act, which I can't see anything on, it makes it really difficult to go forward on that particular debt.
Okay. Maybe I'm not a lawyer, and I think most people on this committee are not, so maybe I'm missing something, but you would only get these attorney's fees if you prevail in establishing that you had violated something in this act, which basically is the existing law with only a couple of changes, which seem to be making false or misleading statements in addition to using obscenities, calling people at times that you're prohibited by law from doing. So I just don't see how this is as overreaching as you're testifying that it is, because these attorney's fees wouldn't be awarded just because you showed up in court. You'd have to then have established that one of these provisions had been violated.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, I understand what you're saying, and it's a very good question, but the reality of it is that the attorney on the plaintiff's side, in order for these cases to resolve, they want attorney fees that generally or may be in excess of the amount of the damages, the statutory damages in the case, and that makes them more difficult to resolve, even if there's just a technical issue. And further, the other side, the defense, has to weigh paying for an attorney to defend this case. Very few of these cases actually go to trial because of the economics involved, at least based on my experience, and because they're attorney fee driven as opposed to consumer damage driven. Hope I answered your question.
And I just wanted to respond to the comment, Mr. Hassan, that you made about the loser pays, and you said that something about it being an equal position. And I submit that it is equal position in a case or in a situation where there's equality among the parties. And in a consumer case, there typically isn't, because oftentimes you have a low-income consumer who may not understand the transaction and be in financial difficulties, and that consumer is in a lawsuit with a company who has attorneys oftentimes on staff or available. So it there really is a disparity in the parties, and I don't think it's unusual in a consumer case for there to be attorney's fees awarded only in cases of bad faith.
And Madam Chair, Jim Marquis again, if I could just respond. I understand exactly what you're saying, but on the other side of the coin, much as we would like to think it's not true, there are consumer lawyers who bring actions knowing that they will be difficult to defend and looking to settle them over time, even when they're not a very good case. And this is just one thing that puts them in a better negotiating situation in those cases, and we're not sure it's appropriate. So,
thank you, and we can have further discussions at a later time about rules of professional responsibility and that type of thing that are meant to deal with those situations. Okay, thank you very much. I'm sorry, we're almost out of time, but I do want to have Matt Wallace, Sybil Hebb, and Keith Carnes come up. I'm willing to go over a bit. If I hope the committee members can stay for at least a while so we can get this testimony. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Should go in the order we were called, or?
You can say, Keith, you want to go ahead?
Okay, I'll go quickly. Okay.
I know. And the only reason I said that is because Matt and Sybil are in the building more often, so go ahead and start. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bonamici, members of the committee. My name is Keith Carnes. I, too, am of a private attorney who brings a lot of fair debt collection lawsuits. I have a client who wished she could be here today. Unfortunately, she's ill and disabled and couldn't make it, but her story is this. Her name is Beverly, and she had a letter from an insurance company saying her disability insurance paid her Sears bill in full. However, when Sears sold their accounts to Citibank, Citibank began calling her repeatedly to try and collect. One morning as she went to call 911 as she saw her son have a heart attack, Citibank was on the phone trying to collect this debt that had been paid. She explained to them that she was seeking help for a dying son, hung up the phone, and before she could call 911 again, Citibank was back on the phone demanding payment. She had to roll her automatic wheelchair to the next-door neighbor's house through the rain, trying to seek help for her dying son. Unfortunately, he passed away, and during the time that her family gathered together for the funeral, Citibank continued to call and harass her repeatedly over a debt that had been paid by insurance. Ms. Hilburn couldn't bring a lawsuit under the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act because of the reason Mr. Baxter explained. Under Porter v. Hill, there's no violation to collect a debt that isn't owed. And no matter how many times Ms. Hilburn would tell them this and provide them a copy of the letter showing that the debt had been paid by the insurance company, she continued to be called repeatedly. And so for the people like her, and I know that's an extreme case, but I repeatedly receive phone calls all the time. I have on my desk a garnishment that was originally issued in the name of Maria Gomez. And the debt collector, trying to collect on this garnishment, sent it to an employer, and they said, we have a Maria Gomez, but this doesn't match. This is our client. This is our employee. They changed it to match and resubmitted it, saying, okay, we'll garnish that Maria Gomez then. I have clients repeatedly telling me that, you know, my name is Scott Johnson, and I'm getting calls for, you know, Scott Johnsons that don't owe this debt. That doesn't violate the UDCPA for some reason. And to me, it's a mystery as to why we wouldn't protect that type of consumer. My second concern is the loser pay issue, especially in the issue of identity theft and a person who doesn't owe the debt. I have to, and I'm sure the other consumer attorneys too, have to have a long talk with people saying they keep calling you and they're trying to collect a debt that's not yours. But if we sue them under the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act and we can't show that, the person who really owes this debt is a consumer, at the end of it, you're going to end up paying all their attorney fees. You know, if we can't show that they called with the intention of annoying and harassing you, only that they called, a lot, and the jury doesn't say, oh, well, it was the intention of annoying and harassing, then you have to pay their attorney fees at the end of the case. And so there's a lot of problems that make the lawsuits under the UDCPA absolutely prohibitive, and those are the two biggest problems that I see. A discovery rule will particularly protect identity theft victims. If a phone company today assigns a debt on a identity theft, let's say somebody steals my identity and they assign it and I don't hear about it for another year or two, I should have some recourse against this person who's out there claiming that I owe money that I don't owe. And even if I contact the phone company, it's already out of their hands and there's nothing I can do to stop them now because the law doesn't allow me a discovery rule under the UDCPA. And so I'll limit my comments to that for now, and I apologize. I was in court until just before I came here. I'll provide written testimony in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Carnes. Matt, go ahead.
Yep. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify before you today, get my protocol right this time. I actually was going to lead the second bit of testimony with a joke, but actually after hearing Mr. Karn's testimony on this issue, I'm reminded of actually just how serious this problem is, not just in terms of inconvenience for, literally what feels like the majority of people in this room being pursued for a debt that they either do not owe or just know nothing about, but also in terms of, just the real harassment, the real abuse, and the real impacts that this can have on people's lives. So, seen written testimony from victims who have experienced the worst of these practices, and I think that that those are the ones that we also need to keep in mind in addition to the annoying phone calls that that so many of us get. So I also attempt to keep my comments brief. We absolutely support the provisions of Senate Bill 386. In fact, I think they dovetail quite nicely with the provisions of Senate Bill 328, not only in providing an additional enforcement mechanism, not an additional enforcement mechanism, but essentially lowering the bar for consumers to seek, redress when they are harmed in these cases, and adding to the list of prohibited practices, a problem that so many people do have, which is just that they are being pursued for debts that they simply don't owe. We think that both of those approaches are good, and we think that, frankly, more enforcement over this industry when we're seeing the kinds of problems that we're seeing, and we're seeing every indication that these problems will get worse, is more than appropriate. So I'll leave my spoken comments there, and thanks again for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center. I appreciate the time today. I am supportive of Senate Bill 286 and appreciate the principles underlying it. When false and misleading statements are made on purpose within the collection of a debt, that should clearly be a violation of the principles that guide this practice. And so we appreciate that expansion, especially also to include debts that don't exist and are not valid. I want to speak just briefly to the specific provisions related to attorney's fees, because I think I can offer some specific feedback on that point. The Law Center, as you know, represents low-income Oregonians across the state, and we provide access to civil justice. Unfortunately, we're forced to turn away 2 out of every 3 eligible applicants for our services because we simply don't have the resources. So the availability of legal assistance to low-income people is, as you all know, very limited. It can be virtually impossible for someone to find access to an attorney if they have violations that they'd like to address through the court system. People like Keith are amazing and provide a great service, but there are not enough attorneys willing to do that kind of work, and the negotiations and the advice that attorneys must give about the burden of potential huge costs of law of attorney's fees based on a loss really deters many people from bringing what may be a very valid claim. And so the rearranging of the attorney's fees provisions as proposed in the bill does, in fact, level the playing field and in an important way that will help better enforce the principles underlying the Act itself. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Committee members, are there any questions? One of the things that I'd like to point out is that the attorney fee provision in Senate Bill 386 was modeled after the attorney fee provision that was in House Bill 3630, which is the Foreclosure Rescue Protection Act that we passed in February of 2008. And it's that same type of attorney fee, allowing the attorney fees to be awarded against the consumer only if the case is in bad debt. So that is an existing law in the Foreclosure Rescue Protection Act that we passed in February. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 386 and adjourn the committee for today. Thank you, everyone, for staying late. Jesus.